الذي خلق السماوات والأرض في ستة أيام خلق السماوات والأرض في ستة أيام ثم استوى على العرش ثم استوى على العرش الليل النهار يطلبه حثيثا والشمس والقمر والنجوم مسخرات ألا له الخلق والأمر تبارك الله رب العالمين ادعوا ربكم تضرعا ادعوا ربكم تضرعا وخفية إنه لا يحب المعتدين صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Surely your Lord is Allah, who created the heavens and the earth in six periods of time, and He is firm in power. He throws the veil of night over the day, which it pursues incessantly, and He created the sun and the moon and the stars, made subservient by His command. Surely His is the creation and the command. Blessed is Allah, the Lord of the worlds. Call on your Lord humbly and secretly. Surely He does not love those who exceed the limits.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
This hour's top stories. Lebanon's Hezbollah chief says ending the U.S. presence in the region would be the main revenge for the U.S. assassination of Iranian General Qasem Soleimani. U.S. President Donald Trump signs into law a controversial coronavirus relief bill that awards struggling Americans with $600 stimulus checks. Also in the headlines this hour, South Korea detects its first 3 cases of a new COVID-19 variant amid restrictions imposed to battle a resurgence of the coronavirus. Hello everyone, those were the top stories. Welcome. The Secretary General of Lebanon's Hezbollah resistance movement says those who ordered and carried out the January assassination of Iranian General Qasem Soleimani must pay the price. Syed Hassan Nasrallah added that Saudi Arabia and Israel helped the U.S. in the murder. He stressed that ending the U.S. presence in the region would be the main revenge for General Soleimani's assassination. Nasrallah noted that the Iranian general played a key role in defeating Daesh terrorists in Iraq and Syria. General Soleimani and Iraqi commander Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis were assassinated in the U.S. drone strike authorized by President Trump near Baghdad's international airport on January the 3rd. Iraqi lawmakers later on approved a bill demanding the withdrawal of all foreign military forces led by the United States from their country. 1 year since the assassination of Iran's top commander, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, by the U.S. in Iraq, Lebanese have paid tribute to him as a man who reinforced the spirit of resistance and martyrdom in the region. Mariam Saleh has a report.
It's been almost 1 year since the U.S. President Donald Trump ordered the assassination of head of the Quds Force of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. The martyrdom of Haj Qasem, along with head of the Iraqi Popular Forces Haj Abu Mahdi Muhandis, has had a major impact on the region, and specifically Lebanon. The images on the streets of Beirut reflect the news which became general knowledge after his assassination. His role as a representative of the Islamic Republic of Iran in assisting the resistance was instrumental.
Even Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah said this, that he was one of the fathers, the main fathers of the victory of the year 2006. And also what followed after that was the training and the equipment that the Islamic resistance got, that the Israelis are now quite fearsome of.
Hezbollah Secretary General has stressed in several speeches that the U.S. crime will not go without punishment, stressing that the martyrdom of Haj Qasem will only strengthen the resistance alliance.
We admit that it was a heavy blow to our resistance alliance. In this life, it was a loss for us, but God Almighty has kept the family and friends and beloved people of Haj Qasem Soleimani for us. Also, the blood of Haj Qasem Soleimani will strengthen and reinforce the path of resistance.
The leader of Al-Quds forces was seen as someone who united many fronts in the region against aggression.
Things are quite interrelated here in the region. You know, whatever happens in what country reflects on the other countries. So his role was quite major, and the act of the assassination that the Americans did was not only revenge of certain defeat, but also a revenge against the defeat of their brains by the brains of Martyr Soleimani.
In a gesture of gratitude, one of the municipalities in southern Beirut named one of the streets after Martyr General Qasem Soleimani, whose name has become immortalized, but what many see here as the spirit of martyrdom.
The important thing that we need to focus on from these examples, from the martyrs that are sacrificing themselves, that our ummah, our nation, is always capable of producing more, and people who have the same spirits. Martyr Suleiman's legacy was quite huge, especially with the issue of the spirit of the martyr.
General Qasem Soleimani was not only seen as a friend of Lebanon, of the Lebanese resistance, he was considered by Hezbollah's commanders and leaders as a partner of the resistance who played a key role in achieving liberation for Lebanon the year 2000 and securing victory for Lebanon in the 2006 war. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
Well, the first anniversary of the U.S. assassination of Iran's anti-terror icon General Qasem Soleimani, along with senior Iraqi military commander Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, is just around the corner. Our correspondent has spoken to a number of Iraqi people about the assassination.
Martyrs Qasem Soleimani and Abu Mahdi Muhandis played a pivotal role in eliminating terrorist groups, including Daesh. They were always present on the ground, briefed troops and provided them with weapons and equipment. As you saw, great martyr Qasem Soleimani went to the battleground in person and led combats. His companion Abu Mahdi Mohandes was present too. These two great men were role models.
الشهيدين البطلين.
The two martyrs, General Qasem Soleimani and Abu Mahdi al-Mohandes, were the real reason behind Iraq's victory against terrorist groups. We shouldn't forget their efforts to extricate Iraq from the clutches of terrorists and making the Iraqi people united against them. These two men were the real contributors to the defeat of terrorists. We shouldn't forget that they adopted great, brave and supportive positions, not only on Iraq, but on the entire region and the world.
General Qasem Soleimani foiled enemy plots with his experience and by being present on the ground in the entire region. The United States was seeking revenge on the person who had thwarted those conspiracies, especially with regard to the Daesh terrorist group. So Washington committed a heinous crime by assassinating Qasem Soleimani and Abu Mahdi Mohandes. The crime was justified by reasons bearing no reality and was condemned by human rights groups and peace-loving countries.
One day, Iraq was overrun by the Daesh terrorist group and no country stood by Iraq except Iran. Qasem Soleimani, accompanied by a high-ranking delegation, traveled to Iraq and brought with him the necessary weapons and equipment to save Iraq. Qasem Soleimani and Abu Mahdi Mohandes were the two leaders of victory over Daesh. They rid not only Iraq and Iraqis, but the world and its people of terrorism. This irritated the U.S., which had supported terrorism for years. So the U.S. decided to get rid of the leaders of victory and assassinated them in Baghdad, which was a horrific crime.
Abu Mahdi Mohandes and Qasem Soleimani played a key role in backing the Islamic resistance and movement to support the oppressed all around the world. Those resisting enemies in Syria, Lebanon, and Palestine knew them very well. Their martyrdom played an important role. These two martyrs had gone through formidable battles during their lifetime, and their martyrdom served as a tough fight against hegemonic powers too. But their assassination enraged many people around the world who all condemned the United States' criminal acts.
U.S. President Donald Trump has signed a $2.3 trillion bill, including a $900 billion COVID relief package, into law after days of stalling and criticizing the legislation. Trump's signing averts a Tuesday government shutdown and restores unemployment benefits to millions of Americans. It now clears the way for $600 stimulus checks as well. The Senate and the House passed the bill last week, but Trump described it as, quote, wasteful and unnecessary. The president had threatened he would not sign unless the individual relief checks are tripled in amount. House Democrats, who have long favored $2,000 payment to struggling Americans, are to hold a vote on Trump's proposal on Monday. However, the measure is expected to fail, as many Republicans are against it. The U.S. is the world's worst-hit country by the pandemic, with over 19.1 million cases and more than 330,000 fatalities. From Washington, D.C., Colin Campbell says the government's $600 stimulus checks are not sufficient for the people in need, but he says the checks can at least postpone the eviction process for many Americans.
It only provides $600 for those who are in need. Think about that. If you are paying a mortgage, rent, you need food, that's already burned up within the first half of the month, never mind a full month of needing additional money to pay off bills. But it also postpones the eviction process for many people as well. There are a lot of things in this bill that the president said he disagreed with, but then there are a lot of reasons why he should have signed it. Will Congress take up another measure to provide additional aid for Americans who really need it? Everybody is in agreement that $600 is not much, but it's still more than $0. And I think that's the overall point that members of Congress were trying to make to the president when he was reluctant to sign the bill. Now, there are those who believe that the president initially rejected it and wanted to call for more money to seem as more of a populist, to seem that he was fighting for the American people. However, there were those who disagreed with the president's process in doing all this, especially in light of more than 300,000 Americans dying to COVID-19. Remember, a virus that the president initially called a hoax, one that he was very slow to react to and respond to. So many believe that, hey, if the president had acted a lot sooner, more lives would have been saved. So if he really was acting in the interests of American people, he would have been more responsive and quicker acting when it came to COVID-19.
In Asia, South Korea detects its first three cases of a new COVID-19 variant that has recently emerged in the UK. Health authorities say the three are members of a London-based family who recently arrived in South Korea. They were placed in quarantine. South Korea is the latest country reporting cases of the new coronavirus variant, which is said to be more contagious. The virus has been detected in several European countries, as well as in Canada, Jordan, and Japan. Over 50 countries have suspended flights to and from Britain. I was trying to give you an update on that story from Seoul, South Korea, where Jennifer Chang, our correspondent, is joining us from. Jennifer, if you are with us, it's good to see you. Tell us what we know about these three cases and the general situation in view of the fact that this variant is far more contagious than the previous one.
Well, already South Korea is in so much trouble because it saw its highest peak of daily new infections ever very recently on Christmas Day, 1,241 cases. And now this mutant strain that has been discovered in South Korea is going to complicate the issue. The South Korean government is under a lot of pressure from small business owners and the self-employed who are complaining that their stringent social distancing measures in the past have hurt them so much economically. And yesterday, the Prime Minister of South Korea on Sunday announced that the country was going to keep its current social distancing level, the second highest level for Greater Seoul, 2.5, until January 3rd, instead of raising it to the highest level 3, which is a full lockdown here in South Korea, to protect these small business owners and the self-employed. And he said, already we have social distancing measures that are stricter than level 3 because 5 or more people, for instance, cannot gather at a restaurant without being fined, without breaking the law under these 2.5 level guidelines. So now this mutant strain is complicating things because this is 70% more contagious than ordinary strains or other mutant strains, variants that have been found in the United Kingdom in the past. It could be up to 70% more contagious. And that means that South Korea is in real big trouble right now. The epicenter is Greater Seoul. The majority of the cases that are popping up daily at such an unprecedented rate are here in Greater Seoul, the most vital area of the country. And so now the South Korean government on January 3rd will have to rethink whether it wants to indeed go forward with not imposing a lockdown. This has not been working. Despite all their contact tracing, and they have served as a global model in this, their social distancing measures and contact tracing are no longer working. And things are out of control here. There are container beds being set up outside of hospitals for older patients and other critical care COVID-19 patients who need intensive care unit beds. But even those are not enough to meet the demand. And so the death rate here is also soaring. And this new variant strain from Britain, the South Korean government, all it could do was suspend flights from Britain coming into South Korea, but those are only direct flights. And South Koreans often take transit flights, so there's no way to trace those. They cannot stop the mutant strain from coming into South Korea, even though they place these incoming people coming from Britain under quarantine, mandatory quarantine for 14 days now due to this variant strain.
Many thanks, Jennifer Chang. Let's just hope for the best for now. Thank you very much for that update, Jennifer Chang, our correspondent in Seoul, South Korea. Hundreds of Syrian refugees have fled a makeshift camp in northern Lebanon after a dispute led a group of Lebanese youths to set fire to their tents. A fire destroyed shelters of some 75 families in the Minya region near Tripoli, forcing nearly 400 refugees to leave the camp. Lebanese media say at least three people were wounded in the clash that took place on Saturday night. The reason behind the dispute remains unknown. Lebanon has seen a rise in tensions between Syrian refugees and locals in recent years. Lebanon has more than a million Syrian refugees who have fled Syria since the beginning of the conflict in 2011. The year 2020 was filled with exceptionally significant incidents, from massive protests to war and destruction. Many people believe the ongoing COVID-19 pandemic could put a stop to these events, but it did not. Let's take a look at some of the most noticeable incidents of the past 12 months.
Australia witnessed one of its most destructive and devastating bushfires in the country's history. During the time known as Black Summer, 33 people died and many more were injured. 24 million hectares of land was burnt, 3,000 homes were destroyed, and 3 billion animals killed or displaced. More than 60,000 koalas were among the animals badly affected by the inferno. Indians started the year 2020 protesting a new citizenship law introduced by the government. The law, which is called Citizenship Amendment Act, gives Indian citizenship to illegal migrants who entered India before 2014 following religious persecutions. The law mentions every religion except Islam. The first wave of protests was held in December 2019 when the bill was passed, but protests continued for the next 4 months. Thousands were arrested and dozens killed, including minors. The rallies stopped due to the nationwide lockdowns the government enforced to curb the spread of COVID-19. A new wave of clashes, the worst in decades, broke out between Azeri troops and Armenian-backed forces in the disputed region of Nagorno-Karabakh. While neighbors and the international community called for de-escalation of tensions, Armenia and Azerbaijan kept attacking and accusing each other of provocation. The contested region, home to ethnic Armenian people, is internationally recognized as Azerbaijani territory, but had been under the control of Armenian-backed separatists since the early 1990s, after they seized it by military force. After weeks of deadly conflict, the two sides signed a peace deal in November. After a four-year inquiry, a report on Australian army war crimes in Afghanistan was released to the public. The report, which is widely known as Brereton War Crimes Report, found out that a group of soldiers within the Australian Defence Force's elite Special Air Services and Commandos Regiment had brutally killed at least 39 Afghan civilians, including children. The report stated that 25 Australian military personnel were involved in the killings. The ongoing protests in Hong Kong started in 2019 over a now-shelved extradition law. The rallies that usually turned ugly resulted in millions of dollars of property damage, as well as mass arrests. However, since the government imposed a ban on public meetings to curb the coronavirus outbreak, Hong Kong has been relatively calm. But every now and then, a demonstration erupts. The anti-government protesters now demand complete separation from mainland China. The Chinese government says the United States and Britain fanned the flames of the unrest in Hong Kong by supporting the rioters.
This is the Heart of Life pounding. IRIB English Radio.
The all-merciful, the all-compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who allowed none to witness when He created the heavens and the earth, and who took no helper when He authored the spirits. He has no associate in divinity and no support in unity. Tongues fall silent before the limits of describing Him. Intellects fail before the core of knowing Him. Terrors fall low in awe of Him. Faces are humbled in fear of Him. And everything mighty yields to His mightiness. So to Thee belongs praise again and again, well measured, continually and methodically. And may His blessings be upon His messenger endlessly, and His salutation everlastingly, eternally. O Allah, make the beginning of this day of mine righteousness, its middle prosperity, and its end success. I seek refuge in Thee from a day whose beginning is fright, and whose middle is anxiety, and whose end is pain. O Allah, I pray forgiveness from Thee for every vow I have vowed, and every promise I have promised, and every pledge I have pledged, then failed to keep for Thee. I ask Thee concerning the complaints of Thy servants against me. If there is a servant from among Thy servants, of a handmaid from among Thy handmaids, who has against me a complaint, because I have wronged him in respect to himself, his reputation, his property, his wife or his child, or because evil words I have spoken about him in his absence, an imposition upon him through inclination, caprice, scorn, zeal, false show, bigotry, whether he be absent or present, alive or dead, such that my hand has fallen short and my capacity has been too narrow to make restitution to him or to annul my obligation to him, I ask Thee, O He who owns all objects of need which are granted by His will and hastened to His desire, that Thou blessest Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, peace be upon them, and makes the one I have wronged satisfied with me in the manner that Thou willst, and givest me mercy from Thee. Forgiveness decreases Thee not, and giving injuries Thee not. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, give me on every Monday two favors from Thee: the facility to obey Thee at its beginning, and the favor of Thy forgiveness at its end. O He who is Allah, and none other than whom grants forgiveness for sins.
Hazrat Fatima's martyrdom points to ponder.
In the name of God, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Salam, everybody, and condolences on the anniversary of a very poignant occasion. Today happens to be the 13th of the Islamic month of Jamadil Awwal. It is the day on which, according to an account, the virtuous Ever Lady departed from the mortal world. It is a day of grief, marked in Iran and wherever Muslims, especially the followers of the Prophet's blessed Ahlul Bayt or household, live. Despite the spread of the coronavirus pandemic, the devotees are clad in black these days in the memory of the lady who, in order to safeguard the spirit and letter of God's revealed word, the noble Quran, for ensuring eternity of humanitarian values, not just sacrificed her peace and life, but also gave to the world illustrious offspring who courted martyrdom in their own eras so that truth stands forever triumphant over falsehood. Who was she? What calamities befell her? Why was she martyred? Where is her grave? Thought-provoking questions indeed. Please stay with us for a special feature in this regard. O Allah, send blessings upon the chaste, immaculate, the veracious, the infallible, the pious, pure, the amiable, the well-pleased, the virtuous, the upright, the oppressed, the wronged lady whose right was usurped, whose inheritance was usurped, whose rib was broken, whose husband was persecuted, and whose son was slain. As said earlier, today we are in the state of mourning for the lady mentioned in the passage that we recited now from her ziyara, or standard form of salutation, which is indeed a testimony to her unsurpassed merits, as well as the magnitude of her sorrows. The 13th of the month of Jamadil Awwal is the day on which, according to several narrations, the noblest lady of all times left the mortal world in the prime of her youth, while defending the dignity of women in Islam, the right to own and inherit, the right to protest against social injustice, and the right to support walaya, or divinely designated leadership of mankind. As a matter of fact, she attained martyrdom in defense of her husband, whose divinely decreed right of political leadership of the Islamic Ummah had been usurped by a clique of incompetent persons who had hijacked the caliphate and were misleading the Muslim masses. She was none other than Hazrat Fatimah al-Zahra, peace upon her, the immaculate daughter of the Almighty's last and greatest messenger to all mankind, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. Born in Mecca to the impeccable Lady Hazrat Khadija, peace upon her, less than a year after her father's Mi'raj, or ascension to the highest point in the heaven and back to planet Earth within a matter of few moments, and his eating of the blessed apple of paradise during the celestial journey, she was named Fatima, which means her devout followers are immune from the fire of hell. While still a child of less than 8 years, she lost her mother to the cold hands of death. She had no maternal material inheritance, since her mother's vast wealth was spent for the feeding, clothing, sheltering, and protection of the neo-Muslim community that was under persecution of the pagan Arabs. Nonetheless, despite her tender years, she so diligently took care of her persecuted father to the extent that she became known as Ummah Biha, or mother of her own father. Upon migration to Medina, her hand was sought by wealthy and politically influential neo-Muslim Arabs, but her father turned down all proposals, saying the commandment should come from God for the marriage of his virtuous daughter. Indeed, when her father's young and virtuous cousin, the first and foremost Muslim, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him, became the suitor and received the affirmative reply, as Gabriel informed the Prophet that the nuptials of these two blessed souls were sealed in heaven by God Himself. The fruits of this auspicious union were two infallible sons and two impeccable daughters, who would rise to the defense of Islam whenever the creed of God came under threat from the hypocrites, former Arab pagans who now masqueraded as Muslims to seize the political power of the Islamic realm. No wonder the Prophet used to rise to his feet whenever his daughter entered his presence and seat her in his place, saying he smelled the fragrance of heaven. To confirm her pristine purity and that of her family, God revealed Ayah 33 of Surah Ahzab when the Prophet once entered her house and assembled under his blessed cloak her young sons, Imam Hassan and Imam Hussein, her husband Imam Ali, and herself, peace upon them all. Gabriel descended with the divine words, indeed, Allah desires to keep away all uncleanness from you, Ahlul Bayt, and preserve you thoroughly purified. As the supreme symbol of feminine virtues, she displayed the highest ethical traits. In 7 AH, when the Prophet provided her with the virtuous Abyssinian maid Fezze, she divided the work equally by giving rest to her maid the whole day after a day's work and discharging the duties that day herself. These are the qualities that make Hazrat Fatima, peace upon her, the pride of the Virgin Mary, and the model par excellence for all virtuous women to mold their life upon. It would not be out of context to say that following divine commandment, the Prophet made a gift of his personal property of Badak to his dear daughter on revelation of Ayah 26 of Surah Isra, which reads, give the nearest of kin their due right, and the needy and the traveler as well. On revelation of this ayah, the Prophet called his daughter Fatima and said, Fadak is one of the territories for which we did not exhaust our horses or camels to acquire it. It is mine exclusively. Now I give it to you and your offspring according to God's instructions. Alas! No sooner did the Prophet depart from the mortal world, her property was seized by the coup leaders of Medina, following their usurpation of the political right of leadership of her husband, Imam Ali, peace be upon him. The Muhaddithe, as she is known because of the fact that angels used to speak with her, was martyred barely 75 days after the Prophet's passing away, when an unruly group of her father's companions, intending to force her husband to swear allegiance to dare Polika rule, flung the burning door of her house upon her, without any respect for her status, thereby pinning her to the wall and resulting in miscarriage, the stillborn son Mohsen. Thus, this Siddiqa, or the most truthful lady who was free from all impurities, died in defense of the right of Imam Ali, peace be upon him, after delivering a memorable sermon in flawless Arabic on the fundamentals of Islam and on the governance of the Islamic society on the basis of the Noble Quran and the precedents of the Prophet. She warned the Caliph and his companions of divine punishment for their unjustified actions, including their seizure of Fadak, whose income she used to spend on the poor and the needy. She told them, "Now hang firmly to this cheap dromedary of Caliphate of yours. But be aware, the hump of this camel is injured while there are blisters and holes in his feet. It carries the scars of ignominy and the sign of the wrath of Allah. Eternal shame is attached to it." In Sahih Bukhari, the book of hadith venerated by our Sunni brethren, the Prophet is quoted as saying, "Fatima is a part of me. Whoever displeases her has displeased me. And whoever displeases me has indeed displeased God." So why a paragon of virtue whom God hails in the Noble Quran as Kothar, or the blessed spring of perpetual abundance, was displeased? Weren't the companions of the Prophet aware of her prime position as the fulcrum of faith? Hadn't they watched in amazement and admiration the veiled figure of the Immaculate Lady accompany her father, along with her husband and two sons, to the memorable Mubahale with the Christians of Najran on revelation of Ayah 61 of Surah Al Imran? Weren't they aware that Ayahs 5 to 22 of Surah Dahr were revealed, giving tidings of the loftiest mansions in paradise to her, to her husband, to her maid Fazeh, and to her sons, when they fasted for 3 consecutive days to fulfill a vow, and on each evening at the time of breaking the fast, gave away whatever food they had to a beggar, to a traveler, and a freshly released prisoner who happened to knock on the door? Muslims ought to ponder upon these questions for perfecting their faith. On her departure from the mortal world, Imam Ali, peace be upon him, carried out the wishes of his beloved wife in the dead of night, laying her to rest in an unmarked and still unknown grave in Medina, so that the shadow of those that had displeased her would never fall upon it, nor would any future blasphemers, such as the Wahhabis of our times, would be able to desecrate it. Thus, Hazrat Fatima, peace upon her, the pride of the Virgin Mary, and the immortal symbol of womanhood for all virtuous women for all time, left for her heavenly abode. But the values that she bequeathed to humanity eternally remain with us, inspiring the daughters of Eve towards faith in God and moral perfection. We again offer condolences to our listeners, and goodbye.
This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Economic divide.
Tension between Greece and Turkey dates back to the Ottoman era, with both nations seeing a roller coaster relationship of ups and downs, which at their peak saw the countries locked in a conflict on four major occasions. With the recent Turkish decision to explore the Eastern Mediterranean Sea for, quote, scientific purposes, but more likely to explore natural resources, the Greek reaction has been one of protest, with the Greek Prime Minister stating that Turkey's actions broke international law.
Be no doubt, Turkey's actions undermine international law and threaten the security and stability of the broader region of the Eastern Mediterranean and of all EU member states. The European Union made it absolutely clear that unilateral actions will not be left unanswered when they threaten sovereign rights of member states.
Now, Turkey, on the other hand, disputes the Greek claims with the Turkish president. He has stated that Turkey, in this case, will always act to protect its legitimate interests in the Eastern Mediterranean, be it in the field of exploration to the protection of Turkish interests in northern Cyprus. Hello and welcome to Economic Divide with me, Kavit Ahwai. In this week's episode, we will be looking into the tension between Turkey and Greece in the Eastern Mediterranean and examine what the economic impact may be on the two nations. Okay, the agency in the Eastern Mediterranean is the key sticking point when it comes to the tensions. Now, back in 1932, the Lausanne Peace Treaty attempted to establish a political balance between the two states, which, all in all, both parties adhered to in most aspects, with the main aim of the treaty establishing maritime borders and sovereignty. Under international maritime law, current conditions see the Greek 6 miles limit, comprised of approximately 43.5% of the agency, whilst the same rule applied for Turkey, only seeing the nation claim rights to 7.5% of the sea. The remaining 49% is considered international waters, or the high sea. So what does it all come down to? Well, put it simply, oil and gas. The U.S. Geological Survey estimated that back in 2010, there were around 1.7 billion barrels of recoverable oil and around 3.5 trillion cubic meters of recoverable natural gas to be found in the Eastern Mediterranean's Levant Basin province. That's a plot that lays largely around the island of Cyprus itself, which is a contentious topic between Greece and Turkey.
Turkey and Greece have long clashed in the region, dating back from the Ottoman Empire, with the remnants of the past still causing tension today. The Eastern Mediterranean in particular has caused no end of diplomatic and military spats between the two states, with the Turkish role in northern Cyprus being one of the hottest topics of contention between Athens and Ankara.
We're here today especially due to the new provocation of Turkey
in violation of Security Council resolutions, the people of Cyprus and especially the youth will not forget and will keep fighting and struggling for the restoration of our human rights and until we return to all our homeland.
But it seems that the main sticking point today is the war of words arising from what lies beneath the Aegean Sea, an area particularly contested between the two states, as both lay claim to disputed territorial waters, as well as the resources that go with them. Turkey have recently started so-called scientific and seismic explorations of the Aegean Sea, something that Greece claims is a breach of international maritime law, as the waters being prospected, according to Greece, belong to them. Yet under the banner of science, it seems the true intention of the Turkish exploration ship is to scope out and find oil and gas resources, of which it seems the subaquatic terrain of the Aegean may hold a valuable deposit of the much sought-after commodities. With both nations laying claim to the area, a host of maps and charts have emerged stating which country owns what. However, neither of them can agree on fixed details, suggesting that the tension caused by the Turkish exploration could lead to an ongoing war of words, a date at the ICJ Court of Arbitration, or worse yet, a conflict between the two nations, something that both have seen in the past. It seems then that the idyllic Eastern Mediterranean, with its host of tourist resorts, sublime clear waters and lush beaches, could see things turn very sour for the local area and economy, unless something is done. Fast.
So, why is oil and gas such a priority for Turkey and Greece? It may therefore be useful to consider how much each nation already has before considering just why they want more. Now, starting with Turkey, it currently holds some 312 million barrels of proven oil reserves as of the year 2016, making it the 53rd largest oil producing nation in the world. However, Turkey is a nation highly dependent on oil, consuming nearly 942,000 barrels per day, a daily deficit of minus 875,500 barrels. Now, moving on to Greece, estimates suggest that it is home to around 10 million barrels of proven oil reserves, ranking the Hellenic Republic 90th in the world oil-producing nations. Much like Turkey, the demand for Greece is higher than the production, with daily consumption at 296,000 barrels per day, leaving a deficit of 280,000 barrels.
In terms of geographical positioning, Turkey and Greece sit on the borderline between Europe and Asia, making the area one of the most important geopolitical bridges in the world. Greece, for its part, enjoys being a member of the 27-bloc European Union, bringing with it a wealth of advantages from free trade, economic ties, and of course the comfort of knowing that the EU financial powerhouse is on hand to back up the vaults if needed, something that the Greeks have turned to in the past. Turkey, however, have been knocking on the door at Brussels now for decades, trying to get the EU to accept their membership into the bloc, something that has yet to materialise for the Turks. There are, of course, multiple sticking points when it comes to the Turks getting into the EU, with the likes of human rights issues and cultural issues, to name just a couple. However, Turkey and the EU also have a difficult situation to deal with in terms of the migrant crisis, something that the Greeks also play a part in. With the Greeks struggling to control their borders from the influx of migrants, including reports of live fire being aimed at people, for some reason, the EU is pointing the finger of blame at Turkey, suggesting they need to do more when it comes to controlling migration routes.
The idea is that we are ready to cooperate with Turkey. What we are doing, and we are ready to cooperate more with Turkey in order to tackle this difficult challenge of migration. And of course, it's important for all the member states, all the European member states, it's important for them to have a good and a strong and a responsible cooperation with Turkey.
Leaders in the EU are also sceptical about the recent actions of the Turks in the Eastern Mediterranean, with French President Emmanuel Macron, for one, showing his distaste at so-called Turkish provocations. With the current tension yet to be resolved between Turkey and Greece, as well as a host of other issues underlying deep in the relationship between Turkey and the EU, it seems that a lot is yet to be achieved before the Turkish flag is raised outside the EU Commission in Brussels.
It gives me great pleasure to introduce Dimitris Papadimitriou, professor of political science from the University of Manchester. Now, he's the director of the Manchester Jean Monnet Center of Excellence and has numerous publications on various EU and Greek affairs. Professor, many thanks for being with us here on Economic Divide.
Thank you for having me.
Great. First off, tensions have started to flare between Greece and Turkey over competing ambitions to access gas reserves in the eastern Mediterranean. Both parties are laying claim to overlapping areas. How do you assess the situation? What can be done to actually resolve this?
Well, this is an issue that goes back many, many years, many decades, in fact. It all goes back to the way in which the Ottoman Empire was dissolved in the 1920s, and also how the post-Second World War settlement was implemented in the Mediterranean. It is a very thorny issue. It is something that the two countries has found very difficult to resolve. The bilateral talks on arranging these territorial waters have been very difficult, and they become deadlocked, partly also because the two countries cannot find a way of resolving this dispute externally. That is to say, by reference to an international court or another international organization that could mediate between them.
Tensions between Turkey and Greece is nothing new, as you mentioned, with the Turkish presence in northern Cyprus to be a particular point of contention, or attention, I should say. You have the flow of migrants between Turkey and Greece, as well as both parties ramping up their military awareness recently. Do you think the EU, for example, can maybe play a part in brokering?
The EU has a very important part to play in this dispute. May I remind your viewers that nearly 20 years ago, in 1999, a Greek-Turkish rapprochement developed very fast, partly as part of a strategy in the European Union to provide Turkey with the prospect of one day becoming a member of the European Union. Now, since then, of course, things have changed. I think it's true to say that Turkey has moved away from Europe in many respects. Europe itself has been having second thoughts about the prospect of Turkey becoming a member one day. In this context, the Greek-Turkish relationship has become even more complicated. On one hand, Greece often complains about the European Union for not doing enough to protect what it sees as a Turkish aggression. On the other side, Turkey often complains that the EU is taking a stance in favor of Greece, partly because Greece is a member, of course, of the club, and discriminate against against Turkey. So for the Europeans, there is a very difficult compromise to reach here. How to treat both countries with respect, but at the same time, how to make sure that the two collaborate closer to resolve the bilateral disputes.
All right, finally, Turkey recently was issued a wave of U.S. sanctions against its defense development body, and that's something that the Greeks obviously have welcomed. Now, do you think that this is going to help resolve the issue in any sense, or will it simply fan the flames further?
To be honest with you, I think that the procurement of defense equipment from Turkey from Russia is something that the Greeks had very little say about. I don't think that Greece is strong enough to influence these decisions either way. But it is important to remember, of course, that the Turkish position within NATO has been under significant scrutiny. There are many members of the alliance that are worried that Turkey is becoming less predictable within this defense alliance. There are also increasing voices within the U.S. administration, which clearly matters the most here, to assert a more punishing attitude towards Turkey. I think that the election of Joe Biden in the United States may actually increase this pressure further.
Okay, thank you very much for that, Professor Dimitris Papadimitriou from the University of Manchester. Thank you so much for being on Economic Divide. It was great to have you.
Thank you for having me.
All right. Obviously, this there's many different angles. We can't forget about this whole scenario, because you have basically the pressure that NATO is exerting on Turkey, and that's comprised of many countries. At the heart of it, you have the U.S. You also have the EU that's applying pressure on Turkey also, even though we said it may act as a broker. Let's not forget the EU has applied sanctions. So has the U.S. So you can see the focal point here has been pressure on Turkey. We have to see how that is actually going to pan out. All right. Let's not forget, you can actually catch Professor Papadimitriou's latest work in his new book, Prime Ministers in Greece, The Paradox of Power, out of now from all the usual outlets and on your screens right now. All right, time to take a short break here on Economic Divide. But don't go anywhere, as we have plenty more coming up after the break. We're going to take a look at other economic headlines hitting the front pages, with some interesting news surrounding the cryptocurrency, Bitcoin. Also, a look at the cultural and military impact of the tensions between Greece and Turkey. Welcome back to Economic Divide with me, Kavita Afwayi. Time now to take a look at some of the other economic news headlines from around the world, starting off with Bitcoin. At the time of writing, the digital currency has hit an all-time high price, exceeding $23,000. The currency rose 6% against the dollar and is up from just $3,600 in March. On to Argentina, a nation that has struggled with its economy in recent times, and it has introduced what's called a millionaire's tax to help pay for the financial cost of COVID-19. It hopes to raise $3.5 billion, and the way it's going to do it is it will tax the richest people between 3.5% and 5.25% on their wealth. And finally, more bad news for the UK, where UNICEF has had to step in for the first time in 70 years to feed hungry British children. With growing numbers of children in poverty in Britain, some £700,000 in emergency funding has been rushed in to cover the Christmas period. Let's now take a look at some of the cultural issues that affect Greece and Turkey, two nations that rely heavily on tourism as part of their economy.
Some people with less open-minded views may suggest that the reason the Turkish nation is not being welcomed into Europe is due to cultural differences, and in particular, religious difference, with the staunch traditionalists in the EU stating that Europe is a Christian continent and a Muslim nation has no place in the pact. Turkey's population is 99.8% Muslim, with just 0.2% being Christian, and is something that is well reflected in the architecture of Turkey, with mosques adorning the skyline across all major towns and cities. One of the most prominent buildings in Turkey can be found in Istanbul, the Hagia Sophia. Built in the 13th century as a Byzantine Christian cathedral, it once held the title as the largest church in the Eastern Roman Empire. In 1453, it changed from a church to a mosque as Islam swept across the region, converting into a museum in 1935, representing a host of religious and historical periods. For Turkey, Istanbul, the Hagia Sophia, and other sites provide a huge economic income for the nation, with tourism thriving in the economy, from city visits to beach resorts. However,